Hello, listeners. I'm Brad Hargraves, the founder of Thesis Driven and the host of the Thesis Driven Leader Series. Thanks so much for tuning in today. We will be featuring one of the top prop tech founders and CEOs of our generation, Spencer Raskoff. Spencer has founded a number of companies, but he's really best known as being the guy behind Zillow. Zillow obviously has become the leading platform for individuals to search for homes and generate leads for brokers across the United States. And we'll learn a little bit about his journey building Zillow, but more importantly, we're going to talk about what he sees in the future. We are going to talk a little bit about things like the NAR lawsuit and impacts that might have on the future of the housing market. But we're going to focus a lot on his latest activity, which is investing in building new companies that can take advantage of the future of the real estate world. So to give you one example about what Spencer's been doing lately, he co-founded a business called Picasso. Picasso enables fractional homeownership. It enables someone to come and buy an eighth share of a great vacation home in an awesome destination that they might not be able to afford otherwise. It's kind of a new model and a riff on some existing models of how vacation home ownerships work. So we're going to talk about that, and we're going to talk a lot about what Spencer sees coming down the pipe in the future and how that informs his decisions to invest in new companies, as well as kind of co-found and incubate new concepts that are really at the frontier of what's happening with real estate today. So we're going to hear his perspective and get his take on where he sees things going in the future. Really excited for this one. Should be a great show. Let's dive in. Spencer, welcome. And thank you so much for joining the Thesis Driven podcast and video series. Excited to have you on.
Thank you for having me, Brett.
So let's just kick off and talk a bit about what you've been up to lately. So I'd love to dig into kind of what's guiding you and your overarching thesis since leaving Zillow. You've been involved in quite a few companies, including Picasso, Q, Recon. Is there any, and obviously investing through 75 and Sunny as well, is there any overarching guiding thesis? Tell me a little bit about how you find ideas.
I mean, the main thing I'm focusing on at this stage of my career is mentoring and coaching. So I'm an investor through 75 and Sunny in about 50 startups, and then I've incubated and co-founded six startups that I'm chair and co-founder of. And I'm teaching a course on entrepreneurship at Harvard. I do a lot of consulting calls with startups. So in the aggregate, I'm basically a coach. I'm a mentor, advisor, coach, and I get a lot of satisfaction out of this, out of trying to help other founders and entrepreneurs achieve their full potential. In terms of the companies that I've found, I have an N of six now, and three of them have former Zillow teams. So the most important thing in startups is the people that you're working with and making sure that you are excited and motivated by them. And so having a shared history with former Zillow colleagues is really valuable. By industry, of the six, three of them are in real estate, three of them are not. By stage, one of them is later stage, that's Picasso, which has a couple hundred employees and has raised a couple hundred million of venture capital. The other five are earlier stage, between 2 and 15 employees each. And in terms of theme, most of the unifying theme across most of what I invest in and most of the companies that I create are around democratization of something, whether it's information, in the case of Zillow, whether it's travel in the case of Hotwire, my first startup, whether it's second home ownership in the case of Picasso. Most of what I try to do is take something that only a small portion of people have access to, either through wealth or good fortune, and try to democratize that so a lot more people can benefit from it.
So you mentioned that of the six companies that you are founded, you have three of them are in real estate. You look more broadly at what you're doing at 75 and Sunny. You have 50 companies. Is that real estate focused, or how do you think about curating those?
The portfolio companies for 75 Sunny are about a quarter in prop tech, About a quarter are in future of work, HR tech, so basically software companies around employee engagement. About a quarter are creator economy, digital media, sort of Hollywood meets Silicon Valley type stuff. I'm in Los Angeles, and so a lot of those are LA-based companies. And then the last quarter is just other things I find interesting and fun and cool. So there's some space, some robotics, some AI things in that. In the prop tech portion of the portfolio for 75 and Sunny, there are a couple of themes. One of them is cloud brokerages, where I'm an investor in Avenue 8, Side, and Radius Agents.
A cloud brokerage is a
real estate brokerage that lets the agent keep more of their commission. So basically, they give the agent less, but they charge the agent less. And so one of my beliefs about the future of real estate is that a lot of the services that brokerages have historically provided to agents are getting disintermediated by the internet. So if you think of what brokerages have historically given to agents, it's lead generation, software, branding, office space, culture, community, technology. Let's take them one by one. Lead generation, most agents are getting that from Zillow or Realtor.com or Google or social media. Office space, they typically don't need as much as they did before. Branding, well, for most agents, their branding comes from their social footprint or their ratings and reviews on Zillow or other social services. Culture, agents are getting these from Facebook groups or from conferences or conventions or from their coaches like a Tom Ferry or somebody like that. So each of these things are getting disaggregated. Oh, sorry, technology. They're mostly buying that from individual tech vendors. They're not mostly getting that from their brokerages anymore. So as a result, there's this this theme which started with RE/MAX in the 60s and 70s and continued with Keller Williams and then continued with EXP and then now continues with other cloud brokerages of giving the agents less but also charging them less, letting them keep more of their commission. So anyway, that's one of the themes of my prop tech investments. And then I can...
So how do you, of everything kind of at 75 and Sunny, how do you decide what to say yes or no to?
It's a very good question, and I'm sure I say yes to too much. Well, I mean, I'm not a venture capital fund, so I don't have a clear investment mandate. Like, it's a lot easier for a traditional VC to say no to things because they say, oh, that's the wrong stage or the wrong sector or the wrong industry or whatever. So I can't hide behind that. So for me, it's a little bit more specific on the idea and the founder and also based on my own bandwidth. I mean, like my bar goes up and down over the course of the year. For example, we're recording this right now in December. In January, February, March, and April, I'm teaching this course at Harvard and I'll be commuting there and I'll be in Cambridge one or two days a week. I'm going to have to raise my bar on new investments and on the amount of time that I can give to founders of my existing portfolio. I didn't do that in the fall. I will be doing that in the spring. So I'm just, a small fry in the land of venture capital. I don't have a huge team. I do have a team at 75 and Sunny that is amazing, but, we're a small group.
So within that, is it about kind of, hey, this, I believe in this founder. I believe in this idea. I want to see this exist in the world. You mentioned you've backed a few teams that you worked with at Zillow. Kind of how do those different factors play into it?
So the companies that I started are a little different than the companies I invest in. So I've started six companies, I've invested in 50 to 60. The companies that I start are frequently my idea, sometimes they're my co-founder's idea, but those are things I'm going to be much more involved in. I mean, I'm in the Slacks of those company founders. I'm at their, their weekly stand-ups. I'm the chair of their board typically. So I'm like super involved. I have email addresses for those companies. I've incubated those. Those are things that I have to just passionately care about solving that problem. I am very passionate about second home ownership and the impact that it can have on people's lives. I'm very passionate about streaming discovery, about helping people figure out what to watch on TV. And so I started a company to solve that problem called Q. So the companies I start are things I'm super passionate about. I'm very passionate about LA tech. And so I started a company called .LA, a media business to cover Los Angeles tech and LA startups. So that's a much, much higher bar. Those are companies I basically work at. The companies that I invest in are things that I just think they're solving big enough problems to merit hopefully successful outcomes as companies, and I'm impressed enough with the founder, and I think I can add value. I mean, I'm also an investor in a lot of venture capital funds where I just give the VC firms money to invest. And so the things that I invest directly in are typically, they have to be things that I think I can also add value by talking every couple weeks or every couple months with the founders and giving advice and perspective. And that's an important bar for me.
So I do want to expand on that a bit. As you mentioned, you know, the rate at which you can do investing is limited by your own bandwidth. So how do you like to get involved in these companies and maybe look at kind of one of your 75 and Sunny investments on one end of the spectrum and maybe like Picasso on the other end of the spectrum where you're a co-founder?
Yeah, the 75 and Sunny portfolio of companies I'm an investor in, just to sort of size these are typically a couple $100,000 investments, usually at the pre-seed, seed or series A stage. And so I'm a very small investor on the cap table. Usually it would be, for example, a founder raising a seed round of $5 million from one or two venture capital firms, and I'll invest, say, $100,000, $200,000 in that round. But once I'm an investor, I make it my business to try to be the most useful person on the cap table. And my goal is, I mean, once you're a portfolio company of 75 and Sunny, I don't really differentiate or think about how much did I invest in this or what stage did I invest in it. In fact, usually I don't even know. Very frequently I'll be on the phone with the founder, helping him or her through some problem, and I'll Slack someone on my team and say, you know, remind me what, you know, how much do we actually have in this company? Because I don't even know. Like, I just know that it's a company that I'm on speed dial and I'm here to help. And the ways that I typically get involved, it's a service business. Venture capital is a services business where the investors are there to support the founders that they effectively work for. And so there are some companies that I'm very involved in. I'm thinking of Intro.co, which is a company where people can book time with me. So it's a two-sided marketplace. You have founders and other people that want business coaching, and then you have people like me that are willing to schedule time in order to give mentorship and advice. It's an idea I'm passionate about. It's a founder I love. I probably talk to that guy a couple times a week by text or by email, that founder. I'm giving them product feedback. Just before this started, I sent a couple suggestions of tiny little things that I think they should tweak. So I'm super involved in that because I think I can be really helpful. And then there are other things I invest in where I don't hear from the founder for months at a time. And, you know, they don't call me because they don't need my help. And I kind of leave them alone. But I'm here to help is how I think about it. The companies that I incubate, that I basically work for, those other six that I'm chair and founder of, it's the same kind of thing, but I work for the CEO. So, the case of Picasso, I work for Austin Allison, my co-founder and CEO, and I'm there to help with whatever he needs. And that can be, you know, it can be anything. It can be fundraising. It can be product strategy. It can be PR. It can be whatever, you know, whatever's top of mind. And I'm just much more involved in those six companies because my name is connected with them for starters, and there are also problems that I'm really passionate about, and that's why I helped start those companies to begin with.
And do you take board seats in those companies?
Yes, those companies, I'm chair of the board of all six of those companies that I've incubated.
And at 75 and Sunny, I assume you're not on the board of 50 companies.
No, I'm not on the board of any of those. I'm on the board of one other company that I didn't co-found called Varo, V-A-R-O, which is a digital bank. It's a TPG and Warburg Pincus backed bank. They've raised over $1 billion of venture capital. It's pre-IPO. I've done this a couple times where I've joined boards of late stage growth companies in the year or two before they go public and then stayed for a couple years after. I just did this with Palantir, where I joined the board of Palantir before it went public and stayed on through the IPO. And then a couple years after, I did this with Zulily. I was on the board of TripAdvisor for, I think, 6 or 7 years after its IPO spinoff. And that's a very different stage than this early stage investing of two employee startups, but it's a stage that I find very interesting and I can be very helpful with because I've seen that movie before. I've done that at Zillow. And as companies move from that late stage series C, series D, series E venture funded, environment to the pre-IPO readiness, and then they're in the chute to go public, and then the couple years after, a lot has to change about a company at that through that stage of its life. And so I enjoy helping companies through that stage. And so I do take a couple board seats right now. It's just the one Varo for companies at that stage.
So earlier you mentioned that a lot of the companies you've co-founded have this central theme of democratization. I wanted to maybe ask you to expand on that a bit. And, you know, in the context of, you know, what are the big problems that need solving in real estate? Obviously, with Zillow, you tackled a really big one of discovery. What do you think of the big problems of that caliber today?
Yeah, well, certainly not discovery. I mean, search and discovery at the top of the funnel is pretty well solved. Although I will make one observation, which is listings have become totally commoditized, and Zillow, for all its success, is built on top of the same listings information as Redfin and Realtor.com and every MLS powered website. So there are hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of websites that basically have the same content. And yes, Zillow has Zestimates, but you know what? Realtor.com has automated valuation models, and Redfin has AVMs, and everyone has AVMs now too. So so it's a bit of a commoditized environment for, you know, and these search portals are innovating on the margins. What nobody has cracked is social at the top of the funnel.
Right.
And Zillow has tried some social features. Different startups have tried social features. So I don't know. You know, we'll see if 10 or 20 years from now, who is the leader in real estate search and discovery. But it's a bit like, if you think of music for a moment, you know, Spotify is built on top of a music database. Imagine if there were a million other streaming services that all had access to the same music. And then they were all innovating on little features like recommendations and playlists and better integration with your car and, you know, better videos or whatever, just other kind of little, that's basically real estate today. And Zillow has this huge lead because it's got an extraordinary brand, huge traffic lead. But from a product standpoint, it's a lot harder to innovate when you're all built on commoditized listings. Anyway, your question was where are the big opportunities for innovation? It's further down the funnel. It's not at the top of the funnel at search and discovery. It is at the very bottom of the funnel on agent productivity, where Follow Up Boss was just acquired by Zillow, and and we saw this every, when I was CEO of Zillow, we did 17 acquisitions, and every time we made an acquisition, the user base was nervous about what it would mean. Now that their favorite software tool, whether it was .loop or Diverse Solutions or Wrenches or, you know, whatever, any of the dozens of companies that we acquired, what does it mean now that it's owned by Zillow? So anyway, that opens up a bit of an opportunity on agent productivity tools at the very bottom of the funnel. And then for the consumer, I think AI is this big open question also, where there's this, all these new incredible technologies available to us through AI, and none of us really know how they're going to impact real estate search or agent productivity.
So you did co-found a business, Hey Libby, that is in the AI space. May you tell us a little bit about that and kind of why you made that specific bet on AI?
So what Hey Libby is not specifically in real estate, although plenty of real estate agents use it. I started it with two former Zillow colleagues, Tony Small, who ran sales strategy, basically helped build the Premier Agent business, and Anna Rodriguez, who helped build all the agent productivity software and internal productivity for our sales team. And they're both great founders, and we've raised a pre-seed round. What Hey Libby's trying to do is use AI for small businesses, for them to do lead qualification. So imagine if you're a interior designer and you post photos on Instagram, or you're a math tutor and you put math lessons on TikTok, or you're a podcaster like you, and you put content on LinkedIn, kind of snippets from your podcast. You get direct messages through all those channels, and you get pings through your websites of people out there in the world wanting to reach you. Hey, will you do my kitchen remodel? Hey, can I be a guest on your podcast? Hey, can I book you for my math, for my kids' math lessons? What Libby does is it provides an AI bot to interact with those prospects using AI. So it will represent you and chat with your prospects and qualify those leads. And it's called Libby because it's link in bio. So the idea is you create your own Libby and then you put it as your link in bio on all your socials, and then people interact with you. And then you, as a business owner, you get a text once the lead is qualified. So, hey, somebody, you know, asked if I could advertise in the podcast. Like, you know, Libby gave back the rates. They said, great. What type of format do you need? What's the timing? Da, 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 da. Okay, that whole conversation has happened on your behalf while you're, you know, asleep or recording a podcast or sitting at the beach. You know, you're welcome. Your Libby has basically acted as a salesperson and qualified that lead for you. So that's what Libby's trying to do. I think every small business is going to have an AI that represents them. Perhaps every person is going to have an AI that represents them while they're doing other stuff. And Libby is trying to be just that.
Very cool. And, you know, when you think about getting an idea like that, was that team coming to you and saying, hey, we have an idea in AI, come help us out?
That team came to me and said, hey, Spencer, we really want to work together again because some of our happiest days of our career were when we were working with you at Zillow. And we have a couple AI ideas in AI. And so they gave me a couple ideas and I helped pivot us towards this one. I said, you know, I think the real problem that SMBs, small to medium businesses have, is they're busy doing their job. And I saw this with real estate agents. You know, they're busy doing their job and they can't deal with inbound prospects. Let's build a solution to that problem. And and so then we went out and built this. So you know, we kind of came up with the idea together based on another idea that they were originally interested in AI. But it stands on the shoulders of what we learned. I mean, Tony Annan and I spent, I don't know, I think 10 years working together at Zillow trying to solve this problem for 100,000 plus real estate agents that spend $1 billion a year of advertising on Zillow. And the single biggest problem for all those agents is lead qualification. It is like, just how do I respond more quickly to the lead? And this is not just a problem that agents have, it's a problem that every SMB has. And AI can solve it. And that's, you know, that's what we're trying to do. So we've raised a couple $1 million pre-seed round, and that's what we're working on. It's heylibby.ai is the URL if you want to learn more.
So I want to pivot a bit to talk about the single family market. There's been a lot of innovative models that have come out over the past 36 months, let's say, of people doing really interesting and creative things with homes, whether that's, you know, we featured a number of those on the newsletter, whether we're talking about, you know, sale leaseback models like Truehold, talking about rent to own models. But one of the more interesting I've seen is this fractional ownership concept, Picasso. Mm-hmm. Would love to kind of understand your arc with Austin there, and then, you know, how that business is doing in light of, you know, where rates have gone and a lot of pressure on the short-term rental market.
Yeah. So Picasso is trying to solve this problem of ownership of second homes. And the, you know, the problem statement is most people would love to own a second home, but for most people it's unaffordable. And the reason it's unaffordable is because these homes sit empty most of the time. And co-ownership can help solve this problem. In fact, people have been doing this forever. Picasso didn't invent co-ownership. You know, two, three families get together, buy a ski house together, buy a beach house together. People have always done this. The problem with doing it yourself, there are a lot of problems. Number one, governance is hard. Figuring out, you know, who decides what, you know, interior design. Scheduling is very, very difficult. Resale is almost impossible. You know, good luck if you buy it with three other families and your needs change and you want to sell yours, then what? Mortgage origination is impossible. You can't call the bank and get a loan for a do-it-yourself co-ownership. So, you know, there are a lot of problems. Property management is hard, et cetera. So what Picasso has come along and done is solved all those problems. You can get a mortgage. We have resales. We've solved scheduling. We've got an app for all of this. We do the property management, et cetera. How is Picasso doing? We now have around 1,500 owners that love it. About 40% of our business comes from referrals. We have tons of repeat buyers that have bought multiple Picassos in different geographies. We've passed $1 billion of gross revenue of sales of real estate. We're in 40 markets in 4 countries. So it's doing really well. We've raised $250 million of venture capital. You know, it hasn't been all straight up and to the right. There have been plenty of challenges. When rates went way up over the last year or two, buyers pulled back, of course. We were then able to sort of reposition Picasso in the market to articulate the fact that in a higher rate environment, Picassos are actually the relative value, right? If you're going to go buy a $4 million home in Tahoe, well, guess what? $4 million at a 9% mortgage is really expensive. You know what's a better substitute product for that is buying a quarter of it for $1 million at a 9% mortgage. So actually, in a high rate environment, Picasso looks relatively better. But it took a little while for us to sort of communicate that message, and everyone had sticker shock when rates went up. But that's where we're at now, and it's taken a lot of grit, a lot of innovation in the product. We've had to build some features that help overcome objections, and we got a lot more, a lot more coming soon. The team is great. It's stuck together through these ups and downs, and the product really works. I own one in Malibu. I love it. I'm a very, very happy Picasso owner. Austin owns a couple, and he loves his Picassos, and it's just a really great product. Like the Malibu one's a good example for me. I live in Los Angeles. I would love a house in Malibu, but the type of house that I want is like a $5 million house. Am I going to buy a $5 million house in Malibu? Like, no, it doesn't really make sense, for me to do that. But I bought an eighth of a $5 million house, and now I only have to pay an eighth of all the operating expenses. So, everything from property management to maintenance to repairs, et cetera, I'm only on the hook for my eighth. An eighth, by the way, is 6 weeks a year. And the reason that an eighth is the unit of sale that we focus on at Picasso is even when people own all of a second home, they typically only use it one eighth of the time, 6 weeks a year. Right. And so I'm a very happy Picasso owner, along with thousands of other folks, for those reasons.
So we have a lot of investors, real estate investors, some venture investors who tune into to Thesis Driven. Someone with your background, someone who's been the founder of Zillow, founder of Picasso, invested in a lot of companies in the real estate space, what do you know about real estate and real estate investing that the rest of us don't? What are misconceptions that you see out there, mistakes you see other people making that, you have the data, you have the perspective, you're not going to do that?
Well, I mean, I'll take a little bit of a victory lap on this commission, the cooperative compensation lawsuit. I've been saying for 2 years that this was a ticking time bomb and it was going to go off. And I was right.
Can you explain a second what you're to our audience, what you're referring
absolutely.
To?
So there's a class action lawsuit, which just reached a verdict, where the plaintiffs argued successfully that the structure of compensation in the United States is collusive, meaning that it keeps commissions artificially high by the listing agent sharing their commission with the buyer's agent. And what seems pretty clear now is that sometime in the next year or two, through the result of a lot of other copycat lawsuits and maybe government action, we'll probably end up with a commission structure that looks more like the rest of the world, whereby buyers will have to pay buyer's agents themselves. So today, the way it works today is if you go around with a buyer's agent and see houses, and then you go buy your house, the buyer's agent, your agent's commission gets paid by the seller's agent. And so you don't really see it or feel it. Now, interestingly, you are actually paying for it because only one person brings a check to closing, and that's the buyer. So you're paying for it indirectly, but you don't realize it. And the real estate industry has done a great job of convincing buyers for the last 25 years that they don't, that quote unquote buyer agents are free when really they're not. The result of this lawsuit and others like it is going to be such that I believe buyers will have to pay out of pocket themselves. If that happens, many buyers will choose to be unrepresented, meaning they'll just see houses on their own with listing agents, and then they'll hire a lawyer to complete the transaction, and they won't have a buyer's agent. If that happens, then a lot will change about industry structure. And this is something that most of the industry is now waking up to, this likelihood. And, it's something that I've been saying was likely starting more than 2 years ago. In terms of, to be honest, Brad, I wish I had more, despite my conviction about that likelihood, I actually didn't lay a lot of chips on the table.
How does one play this? I mean, if you're an investor and you're thinking about, what kind of companies, what kind of concepts benefit from this, is it tools for individual buyers?
Maybe. The reason that not a lot of bets have been laid on the table by me or others is the timeline of this is very uncertain. Like, this could happen in 6 months. This could happen in 10 years. This could happen never. And the implications of it are quite uncertain. So, you know, and until a month ago, the result of the lawsuit were also uncertain. So, like, it's very hard to underwrite things that are, you know, so you know, the time scale is unknown and the certainty is so unknown. So, I mean, I believe what will happen is there'll be fewer agents in the industry and more power will accrue to the top listing agents. Luxury Presence is one of my portfolio companies. That's a company that provides software and website tools to top agents. I think they'll be the beneficiary of a trend like that.
Maybe we'll see some AI buyers agents who, you know, will tell the buyer, this is why you should buy this house. And, here's five houses you should see.
Possible. If consumers are ready for that, that is possible. So anyway, I don't know. We'll see. It's going to be interesting if nothing else. In the portal world, of course, the real estate portals are building up listings businesses to try to sell, to generate seller leads as sort of a hedge against the potential decline in the value of buyer leads. And, so that's what's happening in the portal world. Other thing, let's see, your question was, what do I know that others don't? There's no question, others know this too, but it's probably not talked about enough. Office and commercial are just going to be a total disaster over the next couple of years, and a lot of buildings and offices are going to get handed back to the banks. I have a couple of companies that are in the commercial space. Crexy is one based here in LA that's doing very well. VTS is based in New York. They're doing very well. Butterfly MX based in New York. They're doing very well. So those are all tech companies, or in the case of Butterfly, it's a hardware company for multifamily and commercial that are doing well. But the commercial space is going to be under a lot of stress the next couple of years.
What do you think happens to all this office space? I mean, I've heard a lot of hypotheses. You know, it's going to get turned into apartments. It's going to get turned into.
That's so expensive. Yeah. I haven't heard that one. That's good.
I've heard all kinds of stuff.
I mean, the numbers that I've seen on the cost of turning office into apartments is really prohibitively high in most areas, including California. It makes sense, like, over a cup of coffee, like when you actually sit down and try to pencil it, it's very hard. So, gosh, I don't know. I mean, you know, will they all just become Amazon warehouses, kind of like shopping malls? I don't know. I'm not sure. I mean, we haven't even talked about the gas stations. Like, if you want to take the longer view, you know, the 25-year view, starting in, 5 years, 10 years, California won't be able to sell any more gas cars, and I think a lot of states are going to follow. There's a lot of real estate in gas stations that's going to have to be repurposed. And some people are trying to turn that into EV charging, but I just don't think people are going to do EV charging outside the home as much in what used to be a gas station. Right. So I don't know what's going to happen to all that real estate. I have no idea.
Yeah, it might be I'm going on a road trip. I'm taking a vacation. I stop somewhere, but that's not, it's not the frequency of the use you have with gas stations.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, some of them will become 7-Elevens or whatever. I mean, they already
are. They're going to be fleet hubs for autonomous vehicles.
I guess. Maybe charging stations for autonomous vehicles that are, I don't know. Who knows? I don't know. This is going to be my kid's problem, I think. But maybe not. Maybe it'll happen sooner than all that. I don't know.
So you've had a lot of success. How do you learn, keep your finger on the pulse of what's happening, stay creative, and find out about new ideas and concepts?
Well, unfortunately, for old guys like me, old people like me in their late 40s, the answer is you spend more time with young people. And I do that a lot now. I mean, I remember it happened just a couple of years ago, almost like overnight, where it went from, I would spend a day of meetings in person or on video, and I was mostly the youngest person. And now I'll spend a whole day, I'll end up meeting 20, 30, 40 people over the course of the day, and I'm almost always the oldest person. When I'm at dinner or at night when I'm falling asleep, I'll just kind of recap my day and I'll think to myself, gosh, like, I don't think I met anyone today that was older than I am. And so that's how you learn. That's how you stay young. it's been very valuable for me to have kids. My daughter is in college now. I Slack with her frequently about startups that I'm hearing things about. She's sending me startups. I mean, I just was Slacking with her about something in the social space in real estate. And so that's valuable. And then I've got a 15-year-old and a 12-year-old, and I learn a lot from them about what's actually happening. In addition to that, I mean, my main observation on this is you have to stay curious. And I just was talking to a VC who is older than I am yesterday about this. And he was saying that his telltale sign when he's talking to his colleagues of when it's time to hang up the cleats, you know, when it's time to do something else, is when you stop being curious. And I have a friend, actually, I just had this conversation with another friend about AI, and he's in his late 50s. And he's like, you know, I know AI is a big deal, and I know it's going to change the world, and I like read these articles and whatever, but like, I just am not like ready to roll up my sleeves and spend like 5 days going deep on it and learning everything there is, you know, everything I can learn. And like, I kind of just like, don't care that much anymore. I'm just going to sort of like live my life and whatever happens, happens. And this is somebody that has been at the forefront of tech innovation for the prior 30 years. And that's somebody by his own admission that like, okay, it's probably time to hang up the cleats because he no longer wants to like dig in and learn. So I'm sure I'll get to that point. I'm not quite there yet, but that's something to keep an eye on.
What's the biggest mistake you've made in your business career and what did you learn from it?
The biggest mistake I've made, I have plenty of zeros in my investing portfolio. I had one a couple weeks ago that was my biggest ever zero. It was $600,000 across a couple rounds of my personal money that I invested in a startup through a couple rounds that startup failed. And, you know, I've had plenty of startups that I've invested in that have failed. The biggest through line of those has been me wanting something to exist in the world and not properly separating it, basically being too optimistic, being like, this is a great idea, this should exist, but not being realistic enough about the challenges that company is probably going to face. And so the thing about being a founder or being a good investor is you have to modulate the incredible optimism that is required. Of course this is going to work. Of course this is going to change the world. Of course this is going to become a massive company. With the realism of, you know what, it's probably not for a lot of good reasons. And being able to know when to dial up and dial down each of those two very conflicted bipolar emotions and perspectives. And so sometimes the optimism gets the better of me. That's why I think there are a lot of founders who end up not being good investors. And right. I don't yet know if I'm one of them. I'll know in 5 or 10 years once more of my bets have proven out. But the skepticism required to be a good investor is a pretty different personality trait than the optimism required to be a good founder.
So on that note, would you go back and be a founder CEO again?
It's not impossible. I still, you know, I get pings on CEO positions frequently of later stage companies, and I entertain them. And there are a couple companies that I'm excited enough about that I can see putting on the jersey and getting back on the field again. It's not something I seek, but yeah, it's not impossible.
Did they call you for OpenAI?
They did not call me for OpenAI, though that is an example of the type of company that you know, I think has enough potential and is exciting enough that would probably get me to suit back up. So yeah, it's not impossible, but it's not something that I'm seeking.
Got it. Awesome. Well, I'd love to move to our lightning round questions if you're
sure, if
you're game. So these are kind of quick hits that we're asking every one of our guests here on the Thesis Driven podcast series. So let's jump into it. First question relates to a lot of what we've been talking about. Tell us about one startup, real estate developer or entrepreneur you're watching really closely and why.
Ryan Fraser, who's the founder and CEO of Arrived Homes, I think is a really talented founder. That is a company that's doing very, very well. It's democratizing access to real estate investing in the single family space. And they've navigated really well through plenty of challenges and continue to grow. And he's humble. He's humble and coachable. And those are really important attributes in a founder that I look for.
Awesome. When you and I are doing this podcast in 10 years, 2033, what is the most important topic we'll be talking about here and why?
Probably climate change. And we'll be lamenting that we blew it in the 80s, 90s, and aughts, and probably even to the 2010s before enough people cared. And we'll be starting to see more of the paying the price of it in the 2030s. I mean, the easy answer is AI, but I actually think climate change will be the bigger thing. And maybe AI will help us solve climate change, who knows, but I'm pretty worried. You know, if you talk to kids, when I talk to my kids, like, they're really worried. And they're like, wow, you guys have really screwed this planet up for us. But like, you know, now there's a lot of pressure. And I actually think that the mental health crisis among kids, some of it's due to social media, and plenty has been written about that. But I think a lot of it is actually due to their concerns, their existential concerns, their accurately existential concerns about climate change.
Absolutely. And if you're a property owner, developer, going out and getting an insurance policy today.
Yeah, no, I mean.
That is a lot harder than it was just 12, 18 months ago.
I lost a house to a wildfire in Northern California in 2017. And I looked at buying a house in LA a year ago, and I couldn't get insurance on it. I looked at buying other houses in Northern California after I lost that house. I couldn't get insurance on it. So, I mean, it is already affecting the property market, at least in California, and I'm sure elsewhere.
State Farm, the largest insurer in the U.S., pulled out of California, right?
Yep. Yeah, I had AIG on the one that I lost in Northern California, and I don't think they're writing policies anymore. At least in Napa County, I don't think they're writing policies there anymore.
I mean, these are not woke organizations. These are not companies with a political axe to grind. They are about as ruthlessly quantitative and financially driven as you get. You're talking about global insurers and reinsurers. And the fact that they're messaging this and saying, you know what, Florida, wildlife urban boundary in California,
yeah,
not it. We're not going to do it. That says something.
Yes.
What is one city or place? If you had to pick one city or place to bet on, what would it be?
The city or place I would bet on would be Napa. And its proximity to San Francisco, its quality of life, its weather, its lifestyle, and its sort of antidote to the ills of San Francisco, I think perfectly position it for a great next decade or two.
If you had to pick one technology that is going to have the greatest impact on real estate in particular over the next 10 years, what would that be?
The easy answer is AI, but I think the harder answer and the more specific one will be 3D printing of homes. If we can figure out how to build homes faster, cheaper, and mostly offsite, that is the game changer that we need for housing availability, homelessness, housing affordability, developmental policy, like almost all the problems facing housing. If we can just figure out how to half the cost of building a new home and half the time of it, that's a game changer. I do not have any investments in that space. I've looked at a million startups in that space, haven't invested in them, but boy, that would be big if we could figure that one out.
That'd be huge. It's such a graveyard of startups though. I mean, do you have a view why that is? You saw Veeve declare bankruptcy just a few weeks ago. I mean, why?
It's so capital intensive. But it's going to happen. It's absolutely going to happen. And it may just be the big home builders that figure it out, not the startups or some combination of the two. But the need is so there. I mean, some of the ADU companies seem to be working, But I'm talking about like really printing a house, or it doesn't have to be printing, but just modular prefab construction of housings. And there are some startups that are surviving that, seem like they might pull it out. But I think that's the biggest potential change. If you roll this tape forward 10 or 15 years, if we can build houses much more inexpensively, that's a game changer. Even more of a game changer than agents being able to do a couple more transactions a year because they're using AI in their workflow. Like on some level, yawn, like relative to imagine if we could, build a house in a week. Like that's cool. That's a game changer.
Absolutely. Last question. What's your favorite app on your home screen?
Q. I use Q every day. It helps me figure out what to watch and know what my friends are watching and discover new streaming content. I guess if you didn't let me use an app that I'm an investor and founder in, I would sadly probably answer Twitter or I guess X. In spite of all of the antics of management, I still use it a lot and enjoy seeing what's happening in the world around me through my use of Twitter.
Love, you're the second person on this series to answer Twitter so far. Love hate relationship with it.
That's right. Yes.
Spencer, you've had an extraordinary career, founded some great companies, and you're still really on the cutting edge of innovation in real estate and what's going on. Thank you so much for being generous with your time and joining us today on the Thesis Driven Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I hope you all enjoyed that conversation with Spencer Rascoff, really one of the most brilliant minds in real estate tech today. So it's great to hear a little bit about how he's thinking about the future. I really hope all of you can tune in next week as well when we have a really interesting guest joining us, Stephanie Blake, the CEO of Skylight. So many of you probably haven't heard of Stephanie and the work Skylight's doing, but if you're deep in the world of placemaking, you probably have. She has worked with some of the leading real estate brands, government organizations to program and create awesome installations, events at really marquee spaces, from Moynihan Hall in New York City to the High Line to San Francisco's Ferry Building to Michigan Central Station in Detroit. And she kind of combines a great sense of design and placemaking with what brands want and how brands want to plug in with how real estate owners want to frame, program, and market their spaces. So bringing together a lot of concepts, cities, placemaking, technology. So make sure you turn in next week to hear a little bit about what Stephanie Blake is doing at Skylight. See you all then.